Foreign Affairs correspondent Bill Buesenberg reports on plans proposed by Senator Bill Bradley and Treasury Secretary James Baker. Also, in search of the new Monkees, All Things Considered will go to an open audition in New York for the Monkees later tonight at 5 o'clock on WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. It's 4 o'clock. You've heard the one about the woman who gave her poodle a bath. This happened in L.A., I think, and stuck him in the microwave to dry him off. Remember, the dog exploded? Or how about the exploding toilet? A woman was painting, and she dumped some paint thinner down the toilet. Her husband goes to the bathroom, sits down on the pot, throws in a lit cigarette, and blammo. Well, those are examples of urban legends. My guest is folklorist Jan Harald Brunvand, who studies the origins and the development of contemporary urban legends, true-sounding stories of strange occurrences which come from a friend of a friend or are reported in the media. He's just published his third collection of urban legends. Many of them appear in newspaper stories which were sent to him from around the country. His new book, The Mexican Pet, More New Urban Legends and Some Old Favorites, is published by Norton. His previous books of urban legends are The Vanishing Hitchhiker and The Choking Doberman. Jan Harald Brunvand is a professor of English at the University of Utah and is the author of The Study of American Folklore, considered to be the classic introduction to American folklore. Well, welcome to Fresh Air.
Nice to be here.
Before we start, let me play something for you that somebody once told me.
I can tell you a case that'll make your hair stand straight up on end. There was a young lady who worked in a radio station, and she worked late at night. She conducted interviews, and when she finished, about 2 o'clock in the morning, she goes out to the parking lot, climbs into her car, and she needs gas, goes to a gas station. She tells the station operator, fill the car up. He does. She gives him a credit card. He goes in, he comes out, and he says, lady, the credit card is no good. It's on the hot list. I can't accept it. So she says, okay, she don't want to argue. She's tired. She gave him a $20 bill. He walks in the station, he comes out, and he said, lady, you know, the $20 bill is a bogus bill. What's going on here? You're going to have to come in the station and explain these things. He opens the door. She goes in the station with him. Okay? When she gets in there, he says, lady, there's a man with a hatchet in the back seat of your car. And there was. And they called the police, and they got him.
That was Hugh McDonald, a retired chief of detectives from the L.A. Sheriff's Department. He told me that story in 1982. Had you ever heard it before?
Before 1982? I know it's much older than that. I'm sure I've heard it before that. I call it the assailant in the back seat, and that is version A of it. And version B of it has the woman driving home on the freeway, and right behind her is a guy who flashes his high beams on the lights up into her window, and she speeds up, and he speeds up, and she slows down, and he slows down. And he keeps flashing the beams up and down. And she doesn't know what's going on. And she turns off at an exit, and he follows her. And she goes through back streets to get home, and he's behind her all the way, flashing these lights. And when she gets into her driveway, he's right behind her there. She's really scared by then. I'm not as good a storyteller as your tape, but I've heard it in very dramatic ways. Well, she toots the horn. Her husband comes running out and says, what's going on? The guy in the car behind her gets out and runs up to the car. We're all set now for some dramatic conclusion. And, of course, now we know what it is since we heard the other story. The pursuing driver opens the back door and hauls this guy out of the back seat, who has his hatchet in his hand, you see, or his knife, and says, I saw this guy lurking in the back seat, and every time he raised up and tried to stab you, I flashed the beams to scare him down again. So it's kind of that nightmare situation of late-night driving that teaches a lesson. Check the back seat. Always check the back seat. Perfectly worthwhile lesson. Absolutely fictional story, I think.
Who generally tells that story?
I don't know. I think everybody in cities that works late, that sometimes they'll say it's a shopping mall and they go out late to the car. I think parents tell it to their kids, for example. I've seen it sent to Ann Landers saying, warn your readers, spread the word, and Ann will spread the word. And then someone will write in and say, but we heard that in our community too. Is this happening all over the country? And so on.
A number of the stories in your book are animal stories. And what type of fears or expressions do those stories express?
Well, for one thing, the animals get kind of classified. That is, people are afraid of or repelled by reptiles, snakes, rodents, rats and mice, certain insects and spiders, and their concern, and their pets too. There's stories about pets that either the pet protects them or defends them or comes to some unhappy end or something like that. I'm not studying stories about bizarre and unusual animals, crossbreeds, or mythical animals, or unicorns, or things of that sort, but quite familiar, ordinary things, except that you find it where you don't expect it. You find the rat batter fried in the bucket of chicken, or you find the alligator in the sewer of New York City, or you find the spiders growing inside a boil on the arm or on the cheek that was bitten by a spider and has laid its eggs, and all the little spiders are coming out. See, they're usually in these awful places where they shouldn't be.
But they all seem plausible to some degree. I mean, I still believe that they're alligators that are probably white because they've never seen the sun crawling around in the New York sewers. Does a good urban legend need to be believable?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it has to be believable. They're not jokes. They're not stories that people know are fictional because they have a sort of a kicker at the end and a funny situation, though some of them are funny. But they have to be believable. After all, if somebody tells you, I don't know about the alligators in the sewers. I've always regarded that as rather fantastic. But, you know, if somebody tells you that some thing that, you know, that a rat got batter fried and got served as batter fried chicken, it's conceivable that it could happen. And most of us have some experience with finding some foreign matter in a packaged product, even if it's just a burned cornflake in the bowl of cereal or something like that. And then when somebody tells them a story about finding, they know someone who knows someone who knows someone who found a finger in a jar of pickles and it was cut off at the packing plant, you know, it sounds like it might fit. It would fit in the bottle, even if the detail doesn't fit reality.
Could you tell us the legend of the Mexican pet?
Sure, that does require some explanation, I think. The Mexican pet is a travel mishap story, and it's about American tourists in Mexico who one day see this little doggy. Sometimes they're eating in an open-air restaurant, and it's begging around their feet at the table, and they drop some scraps, and they think it's really cute. And they put down a saucer of water or milk for it, and it laps it up eagerly, and it looks kind of emaciated, but it is awfully cute. And they try to ask the waiter about it, and he either doesn't speak much English, or they don't speak much Spanish, or he just shrugs his shoulders and doesn't seem to care about it. And so they pick it up and take it with them. And they keep it in their hotel room, and it sleeps right on the pillow next to their daughter's head or something like that. And when they go back to the States, they decide they'll bring it home with them. And they have to smuggle it home, since it's illegal to bring this animal back in. So they, again, have to put it in, hide it under a jacket or a sweater or in a carry-on bag or something like that. When they get home, they take it to the vet to have shots for their new pet. And the vet is just horrified because he immediately sees that what they have brought back is a Mexican sewer rat, not a chihuahua. And the hallmark of folklore here is that there are variations. Sometimes they're camping and they see the animal. Sometimes they're on the beach and a little animal comes up. Sometimes the vet gets a few lines in the story. For example, they'll leave the new found pet at home with their old dog and their old cat, and here's the new pet, and all three of them will get into a fight. And here we get threefold repetition, like a fairy tale. And the vet will say, well, this one's a dog and this one's a cat, but this one's a rat. Why are you keeping that as a pet? Or my favorite line that the vet has in one version is, have you people ever heard this animal bark? And they say, no, we haven't. Well, that's because it's a rat, not a dog. Many variations of it.
What type of fears or what's the underlying thought that's being expressed here?
Well, first of all, I classified it as a travel mishap. There are other stories where things occur when you're away from home. And particularly in this story, you're in a foreign country, and there's a definite implication that down there in that country, things are unsanitary. Rats roam the streets, come right into restaurants, and you know, it's a slanderous commentary in a way upon Mexico and hygiene and that sort of thing. The other thing is the language problem, the concern that we'll say the wrong thing or misunderstand something in a foreign country, and you get other stories about that sort of thing. Sometimes they try sign language in stories about travel, and the sign language is logically but incorrectly understood by someone else. Often these things occur in restaurants, according to the stories. The rat, as we said before, is one of those animals that scary stories are told about. And so, you know, it's a whole complex of things. And really, at the base of the whole thing is their kind-heartedness in wanting to adopt this animal and nurse it back to health, kind of Americanize it, you know, make it a healthy little American pet when it was just a neglected little Mexican stray. But their mistake was one of perception. They saw it as a dog but it was really a rat, and it took a specialist to straighten them out. So all kinds of little things working here as they do this.
One of your previous books was named The Choking Doberman, and could you tell us that story?
Yeah, The Choking Doberman is a crime story, crime that supposedly happens in a home, but it doesn't reveal itself until the end that it is a crime. The puzzlement in this story has to do with a woman coming home and finding her Doberman gagging and choking, lying in the hall of her home in some terrible distress. And she puts down her packages and runs to the dog, and she doesn't know, of course, what to do and what's wrong. I always wonder, why not the Heimlich maneuver or something like that at that point? But what she does is put it in the car and rush to the vet. Another story with a vet in it. They seem to be becoming part of modern folklore. And the vet says, I may have to operate. It's nothing you'll want to watch. Just go back home, and I'll let you know what's going on. Well, when she comes back home, she hears the phone ringing, even as she's walking up the steps. So she picks up the phone, and it's the vet. And it's mysterious because he says, get out of the house right away. Don't stop for anything. Just put the phone down and leave. Don't ask any questions. So she does. She's scared by now. And the police come up. And they say, your vet called us, ma'am, and he found two fingers. Two human fingers, people say. What other kind of fingers are there? Two human fingers, people say this, in the dog's throat. We better search your house. And so supposedly then they find this intruder in the closet off her bedroom, clutching his bleeding hand, in shock, and that explains the whole thing.
Now that bears a relationship to the lady, there's a guy in the back with a hatchet, of the intruder in the car.
That's right, yeah. And in fact, the first time I heard the Choking Doberman, what I should say perhaps, in fact, there are several themes there that I recognize from other stories. The first time I heard the Choking Doberman story, I thought, now, where have I heard before of a warning that said, get out of the house right away because there's someone lurking in your house? Ha, the babysitter and the man upstairs, of course. The babysitter got all the threatening calls, usually three of them. She calls the police and says, somebody's calling me up and saying, have you checked the children? I've got the children. I'm going to get you. And she said, I'm scared. So they trace the call, and the next time the phone rings, she picks it up, and it's the police or the operator saying, get out of the house right away. The calls are coming from the upstairs extension. And I said, that's the same motif. Here it is. The intruder is in the bedroom. He's not calling, but the telephone warning. And a lot of intruders in these stories or would-be assailants lose their hands or their fingers, or in the case of a classic urban legend, the hook that the man had in place of a hand is found dangling in the door handle. So these themes just keep recombining and being re-elaborated in different ways and absorbing motifs from other stories. That's why when you see the subtitle of my book, I have new in quotation marks. The newness is a kind of a surface thing because older stories lurk beneath them.
My guest is Jan Harald Brunvand, and he is a folklorist from the University of Utah. His latest collection of urban legends, or new urban legends, is called The Mexican Pet. The biggest legend, or I guess maybe more appropriately put, the biggest rumor in this region has been about a television newscaster involving a gerbil and a bizarre sexual practice which is alleged to occur among gay men. And you write about this as the colorectal mouse story. Can you give us the generic version of
this
story?
Sure. When you say I write about this, I did not write about the specific Philadelphia account of it. What I wrote about was the version I heard, and generic is a good term for it. I heard it first in the fall of 84, and it was just somebody saying, hey, do you know what they're doing now? Or do you know what I heard happened in an emergency room? This guy came into the hospital, and it's called gerbiling, and I made up the term colorectal mouse. I've heard it as a mouse, a lizard, or a gerbil used in this alleged practice among gay men, and it's a slanderous general story about homosexuals. And I heard it repeated at the American Folklore Society meeting, and I don't mean to suggest that folklorists are standing around gossiping, but what they're saying is, and the meeting that year was in San Diego, and people come from all over the country to the meeting. It's an academic organization. What they're saying was, hey, Brunvand, here's a story that's all around our campus or around our town. Have you heard it? In every case, it was this generic version. There is this guy who, and he comes in, and one person said it's a mouse, and one said it's a gerbil. Well, I think I heard about your Philadelphia outbreak of it attached to an individual about as fast as you were hearing it here. For one thing, I made a little mention of it in an article I wrote in Whole Earth Review in the fall of 85, and some readers of that magazine here in Philadelphia wrote to me and called me up. For another thing, when the media, especially the print media, started to try to track it down, they discovered this little reference in my article and started calling me up. And I was absolutely shocked and distressed to hear it told about a specific person, and that people were believing it about a specific person, and that other innuendos and jokes and wisecracks were picking up on this. Because I said, it's just an urban legend. It's a widespread legend. It's been around for a couple of years. What a terrible thing that it's now getting told on a particular person as a true story.
Was this the first time that you knew of that it had been attached to a particular individual?
For that story, yes. And I, of course, know other stories about individuals. There are stories about ball players and television personalities. There are stories about Johnny Carson. There are stories about Michael Jackson and so on. Usually not as damaging or, you know, they're silly stories usually. But this is the first time that I've heard a story of this kind about an individual, and certainly the first time I heard this particular story attached to an individual, you know.
Part of the generic version of that story is that there's always an emergency room worker that knows this firsthand.
Mm-hmm.
Is it?
Yeah. In fact, there's a genre there. See, there's a genre of emergency room stories, people that are brought in as a result of some accident or some practice. And the people that tell them usually know someone who knows someone who works in a hospital. And it starts probably with some gossip around, you know, late at night when there's a little lull, having a coffee break or something. I think the paramedics and the doctors and the nurses and the receptionists and so on sort of share stories about what's the worst case you've worked on, or what, you know, whatever, you know, what kind of things happened at that other hospital you worked at and so on. And you know, as these circulate, people get the idea that they've heard it from someone who was really there, but they haven't really. Incidentally, I call this I refer to this chain of transmission sometimes as being the FOAF, the FOAF. You could say the FOAF syndrome or something. It's the friend of a friend, the friend of a friend.
Do you think that this particular rumor, does that relate to AIDS fear at all?
Or? I think it's a possibility. I've never heard anyone say, here's a story that shows you how you can get AIDS or anything like that. But I think it feeds into a prejudice against gays that AIDS is associated with them, and that this practice people regard as true, you know, is repulsive and upsetting. And I think there are various examples of kinds of phobias or kinds of concerns that people have that express themselves in jokes and in legends. There are stories, for example, about immigrants, Southeast Asian immigrants, stealing and eating our pets, and the people who tell them think the stories are true, and they don't consider themselves prejudiced against Vietnamese or Laotian people or something like that. They just consider themselves as better and more civilized, and they eat things like cats and dogs, but we don't. The French eat horse meat, and do we tell stories about the French being, uncouth barbarians or something?
Now, when this gerbil rumor was going around, there were counter rumors to that. One counter rumor was that it was rumored that another television station had planted the original rumor.
I didn't know that. That I wasn't aware of, but that's interesting because...
No, I'm just saying this is a rumor I heard.
Oh, I would say it is a rumor. Why I say it's interesting is that sometimes you will get a very similar thing with commercial and business rumors. There'll be a story about a particular fast food place, say a hamburger chain using worms or kangaroo meat or something like that, and people will say, you know, that was started by Wendy's or that was started by Burger King. Or something like that. Or people have sometimes asked me if some of the stories about Procter & Gamble were started by other companies. And I always think that's a very silly idea, that business doesn't operate that way, that, you know, you have a committee making up negative rumors about other people. Do you want me to guess a little how that rumor might have got attached to an individual? Because I do have a kind of possible scenario in mind, and this would be my guess. My guess would be that, in the first place, people in the news, people in the public eye, are there because they're interesting, and they remain interesting as long as people like to watch them and like to hear from them and so on. And so stories go around, and people are quick to listen to them and want to know them. And I would guess there might have been some other gossip about this individual. And then this story comes to town, and somebody said, well, that sounds like so-and-so. That could have been so-and-so, right? And then the next person says, I bet you that was so-and-so. I think I heard it was so-and-so. And before long, it's lost that kind of disclaimer, could have been, might have been, I heard, and it's just, it was so-and-so. See, I think that the rumor, the generic story, got grafted on to possibly some other gossip around town. Now, the encouraging part of this is that rumors and legends of this kind usually circulate very actively for a short time, and then people lose interest in them. They fade away, and there's nothing as old hat as last year's rumor. So we can look forward, hopefully, and think that this won't do permanent damage. I hope it doesn't. I certainly hope it doesn't.
Do you? I know you wouldn't know the answer to this question, but do you have any thoughts on whether or not you would trace the origin of this rumor back to malicious intent on anybody's part, or is it a more subconscious thing than that?
Well, I would like to think it would not be malicious intent. It's certainly possible, but I think it's more likely. I mean, it wouldn't. I think it's more likely to be just the process of person-to-person communication, just people telling each other. It wouldn't. Well, for one thing, if you wanted to plant a rumor and have it succeed, you could probably work for years doing it and not succeed. It's very hard to invent things and spread them. But when these things spread, it's because, you know, everybody's telling everybody else. And I think they tell it with the idea that it's something true. It's something validated. It's something that they think there's a source for. So I don't think it's a malicious spreading.
Is there any way to track the growth of a rumor? What I'm thinking here is I got a sense with this previous rumor we were talking about that there was a kind of embryonic hatching period where it festered for a little while, and you'd hear it a little bit here and mm-hmm. there, but it wasn't like really out on the street, and then a week or two later that everybody's talking about it. Is that typical for rumor to kind of fester and then explode?
Well, maybe I should offer a little disclaimer here rather than a direct answer to your question. The dynamics of rumor circulation is more in the domain of sociologists and psychologists than folklorists. There's less to a rumor, which makes it a little easier to track and to draw a flow chart for how it got from here to there, or to test with an item that you might try to pass on and see where it gets. And to some extent that has been done, and there are some books about it. But with the urban legend, where there's a more developed plot and there's more complexity, by the time I spot one of these stories, it's already all over the place. Now every now and then I'll hear a new story, but again, I'll hear it quickly from lots of different places. Let me see if I can give you an example, though, of one where something like this seemed to have happened. There's a cookie company, Mrs. Fields Chocolate Chip Cookies. All right, you know them in this area? They sold in the shopping malls and so on. Happens the headquarters of the company moved in 1982 from California to Park City, Utah, Park City being a ski resort town just outside of Salt Lake. And in spring of 83, I started hearing a story about somebody having a cookie recipe that was from some famous company, except they had to pay an outrageous amount of money for it. They were told it was $250 on the phone, but when they got the bill or when they got the credit card charge, it was $250. And so they were sharing the recipe with all their friends. They had it photocopied and they were handing it around. For a while, it was just a generalized story. I gave a talk at a folklore meeting in Logan, Utah, at Utah State University in June, I think, of that year. And somebody wrote to me and said, some of the things you talked about sound a little like this story, which doesn't sound true. By fall 83, one of the papers in Salt Lake City had written an article saying, the Mrs. Fields Chocolate Chip Cookie Company that's been in our state now for less than a year has had this story attached to them. People are claiming they called Mrs. Fields. They didn't. They know someone who did. And we're charged $250 for this. So it seemed to be a kind of a generic cookie recipe story focusing on Mrs. Fields Company. And I have been getting photocopies of various forms of the recipe with a little story always on the same sheet and a little line, you know, share this with your friends because they tried to rip somebody off for this much money, from all over the country. The Salt Lake newspaper, by the way, got Mrs. Fields on the phone, and she said, oh, yes, I heard that on a plane. I heard it at a business meeting. I heard it from some women at a picnic. I've been denying it. She said, I took one of the recipes and baked them, and they're not as good as my cookies. It's reached the point now that the company has little disclaimer posters up in some of their outlets. So it looked to me like you had a kind of, here's what I'd guess. Somebody had a really good cookie recipe. As that company moved to Utah and we became aware of it there and we started seeing them in the mall, someone said, boy, those cookies are almost as good as Mrs. Fields. And after a while, they were saying, those are Mrs. Fields' cookies. That's the Mrs. Fields cookie recipe. But how about all this bizarre stuff about calling the company? And do you know where this comes from? It's the old red velvet cake story. I write about it in my first book. Woman is at the Waldorf Astoria in New York City. The dessert is a bright red cake with a white frosting. She asks for the recipe. The chef sends it out with his compliments. Not quite with his compliments. $50 for chef's secret recipe. She doesn't want to pay it, but she said she's told you ordered it. You have to pay for it. Sometimes they send it COD, and she can't resist paying for it. So she typed. Years ago, they would type it up with carbon paper or mimeograph it and hand it around. And so the old story about another dessert food in another company has been updated as a story about this Mrs. Fields chocolate chip cookies. We now have a telephone. We now have credit cards in it. And we have a shopping mall outlet where they're sold. It's all just an updating of the old story.
So all this stuff really cross-fertilizes itself.
It certainly seems to. Incidentally, I had a student do a taste test in class. He went down to the mall, bought a bag of Mrs. Fields cookies, went home and baked them from the recipe. There's some really funny things about the recipe that I won't get into. We ran a taste test in class, trying not to say which were better, but which were the store-bought cookies. And we failed it totally. 50-50 in the class voted for each cookie.
My guest is Jan Harald Brunvand, and he teaches at the University of Utah. He's a folklorist and a specialist on urban legends. His most recent collection of urban legends is called The Mexican Pet. Well, here's one that I heard recently. Actually, I'll ask you to tell it. It's the one that I understand originally circulated about Reggie Jackson, but I heard this about Lionel Richie. Do you know which one?
Yeah, I do. The thing about this story, it's a lot like a joke in that it has a punchline. And when you say it's about Reggie Jackson, my inclination is to say, oh, shucks, there goes the story. But he's grimacing as I say
that. I'll tell you, we can come back to this later.
Maybe the listeners will forget what we said. No, I mentioned Reggie Jackson earlier, too. The way I first heard it, and I wrote about this in the second book, I call it the elevator incident. And I looked into it and wrote it up in the book, in The Choking Doberman, and then I mentioned it here. I heard it this way first. Three middle-aged ladies from some city in the Midwest, Indianapolis or Cincinnati or Detroit or Cleveland or something like that, never been in New York City, and they decide to go together and visit the Big Apple, you see. Often they're warned by, say, the travel agent, be really careful in New York. It's a big place and anything can happen. Maybe the airline stewardess adds a warning, maybe even the cab driver. So they've kind of been set up to be worried. And the first day, in their hotel, they get in the elevator to go down to the street and go sightseeing or shopping or something. And the only other person to get on another floor is this very large black man with a dog and a leash. And the door closes, and all he says is, sit. And these women sit down on the floor. And he looks at them in surprise and with a smile on his face and said, I'm sorry, ladies, I meant the dog. Sometimes he says, sit, lady, which makes it a little funnier. And they get up again, and they all sort of cover their embarrassment with a little conversation. Sometimes they ask him to suggest a restaurant, a good restaurant for dinner, and he suggests one, which then allows, and it is Reggie Jackson, supposedly it's Reggie Jackson in the elevator, allows him then to, he prepays their meal for them. Sometimes he's sitting at a table in the corner kind of waving, and the waiter says, you must have made a hit with Reggie Jackson, he paid for your dinner, or he sends champagne to the table. Or he notices the number on their room key and pays their room bill and leaves them a note. I've had people say, I know somebody who knows someone that has the note. It goes on and on. It wasn't true. Absolutely untrue. Sports writers all over the country called Reggie Jackson. They called his agent. They called his manager. Any spokesperson they could get hold of, they kept being told, no, 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 it's not true. Well, recently I've been hearing that coming from Las Vegas. They're on vacation in Las Vegas. They have some money they've won. One of the women is going to go up to the room and leave the money so they won't gamble it all away. She goes up in there's still an elevator in the story, but this time the man with the dog is coming down the hall and he says, sit, sit lady, hit the floor lady, or in my favorite line, sit whitey. The dog's a white dog. And in any case, the woman drops to the floor, holds up her purse or her money, and this time it's Lionel Richie who apologizes, the same old thing.
Well, the version I heard was in Atlantic City.
Oh, it's Atlantic City. No.
Good. And the punchline, which was given much more artfully than I did when I gave this away, was when they check out of their room, they go down to pay the bill, and the clerk says, well, it's already paid, and there's a note for you. And the note reads, thank you for the funniest thing that's ever happened to me in my life, Lionel Richie.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I heard this. It is a friend of a friend story
sure.
that I heard it from.
Let me say, I think one of the funniest things about that story in either form is that the women do not recognize this person whose picture has been in the media for, many, many, many times, that they don't recognize who this person is.
Well, the person I heard it about, the woman mm-hmm. in the elevator, she was described to me as somebody that's not too keyed into what's happening in that way, and also was a little fearful of, let's say, an urban setting.
Yeah, it underscores that naivete and inexperience and so on, sure.
Now, the person, the way I heard this, it was a friend of a friend. Mm-hmm. My friend who told this to me had heard this from the wife of a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, it was the doctor's secretary who told the doctor this story, and it was about the secretary's sister.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know the doctor, so it's almost as if the doctor reported it through that chain of events, it's almost as if the doctor told me this story about his receptionist secretary.
Mm-hmm.
Yet it's this apocryphal story that didn't ever happen, but it's just this, it's another urban legend.
Yeah.
I mean, is somebody lying here, or does, what's, it was really disorienting
well,
to read.
Well, those are the possibilities. Somebody's lying, or somebody's treating it as a joke, but part of the joke is to tell it seriously. No, I find in most cases people have sincere belief that the story they heard and the story they're repeating is true. And we are not inclined, when someone tells a story like this, to say, give me that name, let me check. We're not going out, you know, following it down to its supposed source. Sometimes, I think what happens is, one of the people who's telling it is telling it as something she's heard or he's heard from a friend. But the listener understands it to be happened to the friend. And sometimes, you know, you will go back and ask and say, no, that was, I didn't really happen to me, but I heard it from someone who knows someone. And then on it goes, trying to find the source. Both versions, the Reggie Jackson and the Lionel Richie one, have been printed and in everything from respectable newspapers to the National Enquirer. In fact, both Salt Lake City newspapers, who have a morning paper and evening paper, ran the story about 2 days apart. In one of them, it was in a feature column, and it had the little subhead, true story, ? But it ended up the friend of my source has the note. See, and the other one, it was in a sports column, and the writer had a picture of Reggie Jackson. It's a normal picture of the ball player with his uniform on, and it doesn't prove anything. It's like having a picture of a cat with a dead cat story, and my rule is never believe dead cat stories. And at the end, he said, "Isn't it nice to hear an example that shows us that these big sports stars are really nice guys underneath all the things we read about scandal in sports and the big salaries and the lifestyle and so on." Well, it is nice, but it's not a true story.
Some rumors that have made the biggest impact have been ones that have been attached to companies.
Mm-hmm.
I think the classic, or one of the classic rumors, is the one about Procter & Gamble. Can you tell us that?
Yeah, well, what happens here, people will say, you know, that Procter & Gamble trademark, that's a satanic symbol, because they've heard it from someone or they've read it from someone. And people say, what symbol? And then they look at the products in their home, and there it is, that little peculiar logo, the man in the moon enclosed in a circle with 13 stars in the sky. What could that have to do with soap and toothpaste and paper diapers, disposable diapers, and cake mixes, and loads of things, shampoos and so on that company makes? Well, I'll say it's a satanic symbol. You know, you can see that. There are 13 stars. You look at the way the hair is formed on the man in the moon to fit in the circle. It's a horn. You know, if you hold it up to the mirror, the curlicues in the beard form 666, and they'll show you the passage in Revelation that says 666 is the mark of the beast. It's right there, and I looked it up to see. It's there in the Bible. And it will elaborate sometimes into a story that the founder of the company made a pact with the devil, and that's why it's on these products, that the company is donating to the Church of Satan, and that's why they won't change the trademark, and that the president of the company has been on national TV admitting the whole terrible thing. No, not true. And it did very little good for Procter & Gamble to say, look, the 13 stars meant, we picked that way back, you know, at the turn of the century or something, to stand for the 13 original colonies. The man in the moon was as innocuous and as popular a little image as the happy face little sticker is today, and we've had that trademark for years. And you know, how could you bury 10% to the Church of Satan in the annual report or something like that?
Well, how do you think it started, and why Procter & Gamble?
Well, I think it probably started from people just speculating on the symbol, on the trademark. It is, as I said, an odd little picture to have on these modern products. And there's a certain pseudo-logic about saying astrological symbols can be associated with witchcraft or Satanism or something like that. I think Procter & Gamble, because it's a huge company and it's a very familiar set of products, and the promotional activities for years, the image has been of purity, 99.44% pure, it floats. You can hardly think of Ivory Soap without that old slogan. And so many times the legend has an ironic twist then on the dark side of this big all-American wholesome company is this satanic thing. That's just guesswork, but you know it seems to me to be kind of a pattern there.
Now I've heard recently somebody asked me about had I heard the rumor that Baskin and Robbins is involved with Mooney's. Has that made the rounds?
I heard that a couple of days ago. I've forgotten where I was a couple of days ago. I haven't been able to check my mail for almost 2 weeks. It wasn't making the rounds the last time I checked, though it well could have. Companies, and I've had people say, you know, the Mormon Church owns something or other. They know I'm from Utah, and they want to keep me up to date on things, and the Moonies control such and such. But I hadn't heard that specific one.
How about fast food rumors? What have been the classics?
Well, the batter-fried rat, not to give it too fine a point, is certainly a classic. And here you get both the rumor level, I heard that someone got a rat at such and such a place, and the legend level, where you have characters and dialogue and action and resolution and so on. The guy and the girl, and they buy the bucket of chicken, and they're eating it at the drive-in movie, and she says, mine tastes funny, and he says, mine's okay, let's turn on the lights. And they find the rat tail protruding from the piece of chicken that she's been gnawing on, and they sue the company and win lots of money and so on and so on. Certain contaminated food stories and fast food stories seem to be popular in certain countries. I found in Norway, very, very big was dog food on pizza. Supposedly, these pizza places, becoming a popular snack food in Scandinavia, were using dog food as the ground-up dog food, the meaty kind, not the dry kind. And I remember seeing some headlines, you know, vuv vuv på pizza or something like that in Norway. There's doggy food in the pizza.
There was rumors about worms and kangaroo meat in.
Yeah, yeah. I've heard that. I've heard the worm one told on McDonald's, and other people say no, it's Wendy burgers, and that's what makes them hot and juicy. I've seen disclaimers that point out that worms by the pound cost more than beef, and that there's no particular reason to import kangaroo meat to put in burgers when beef is available.
So the companies have responded to this.
I'm not sure exactly. Folklorists and sociologists and so on have said, no, these stories aren't true. I don't remember. I don't know if I think McDonald's did. I think McDonald's had to deal with a Satanism rumor of its own, and they denied that, of course. I don't know if they've actually. The principle I would see in companies handling these is not to restate the rumor. See, Bubble Yum shouldn't say, no, there are no spider eggs in our packages of bubble gum, or Pop Rocks shouldn't say, it's not true that little Mikey ate Pop Rocks and drank soda and exploded. And they didn't in their campaigns against it. They just said someone's been spreading a bad story about a good product. And then they proceeded to explain what made Pop Rocks tingle in the mouth and how the amount of carbon dioxide released could in no way blow you up or anything like that. I was surprised to see the Mrs. Fios company putting in their poster, the story you heard about someone paying $250 for our recipe is not true, because there is the story. And if you haven't heard it, it's there for you to read.
There are a number of rumors that involve religion. There were two. One I had heard many times, but the other I had never heard. One about E.J. Corvette, mm-hmm. and I think many people have heard that. But the other one, which was a surprise, was the secret Jewish tax on Jewish food. Can you tell us about both of those?
I can't tell you about the first one because that store chain isn't in the West. And let's see, remind me what it stands for. Jewish Korean Veterans. That's right. I mentioned that in passing because somebody wrote to me and said something you had written about anti-Semitic notions in folklore reminds me that that's what this company name is supposed to mean. I don't think that company is in the West. The Jewish secret tax idea, it has some similarity to the Procter & Gamble idea because people will base their idea on a symbol that they see on packages. And they'll either read or hear on the radio or hear from a friend that these symbols signify some nefarious thing that's going on. What are the symbols? Well, they're the markings on kosher food. The U, the K, or the word parva, neutral. And they're right there on lots of products. And people will say, well, you know, in order to have the products okay, there's an expensive process that companies have to go through, and this in fact is a tax that all Gentiles are paying every time they buy the products. And so I have seen stickers. I reproduce one in the book. They're often kind of homemade, sloppy-looking little stickers printed up in some inexpensive way, and they'll say secret Jewish tax on food, and they'll repeat the little symbols. And you'll find them sometimes in supermarkets. Somebody's gone around and stuck these on packages. I've also listened to fundamentalist Christian radio programs where they'll dwell on this, and I've sent my name in a few times to get the literature, and it's dreadful stuff, hate literature that drags up all kinds of other things. The Holocaust didn't exist and that sort of thing. And some places will sell these stickers, and they're on a strip of paper, and you can carry them around the supermarket, peel them off, and stick them on things. I don't know what would happen if you were caught. A warning against this supposed Jewish secret tax. It's not really quite a legend, but it certainly shows people acting out a belief that they have.
There was another rumor. Well, actually, I don't know if this is really a rumor or not, but it was the Gay Jesus film.
Well, yeah, that took the form usually of a petition. Somebody would hear from somebody, and often this circulated on the radio on call-in programs that had a Christian, born-again, conservative kind of angle. And somebody would claim that they had read somewhere, they knew someone who knew that there was a film being made depicting Jesus as a gay swinger. And they would have the name of a supposed company where the film was being made, and so they'd get the petitions going, and people would sign them, and eventually, of course, they would try to find the place to send the petition, and then the track just leads nowhere because, as far as I can tell, there isn't any such film being made. There are films all the time that shock certain people or worry certain people, but that particular script or plot, it does not represent any actual film, and the references to it are pretty spurious.
My guest is Jan Harald Brunvand, and he's the author of a collection of urban rumors and urban legends. His latest collection is called The Mexican Pet. He's also collected stories in collections including The Vanishing Hitchhiker and The Choking Doberman. What have some of the longest lasting rumors been with contemporary variations, that have gone back decades, and why have they lasted?
Well, I think The Vanishing Hitchhiker must be the all-time favorite American urban legend, and it's a little bit odd in a way that I use that as a title story because of all the legends, and I probably looked at, close to 300 by now, not necessarily all that I've written about, but I have notes on a lot at home. And of all the legends I have chosen to study, that's the only one that has a supernatural twist. In a way, it belongs, with rural legends or traditional legends rather than with modern legends. But it certainly has been updated. The core idea of the Vanishing Hitchhiker story that is very old is that of a spirit returning and trying to get back to its home. So in the story, in an older version, the girl is seen standing by the side of the road on a windy, cold night wearing a light party dress. And a guy drives by, and then he stops and backs up and asks her if she'd like a ride. And she says yes and gets in the back seat. And usually he lets her borrow a sweater or a jacket or something, and she tells him where she wants to go. He drives into town, goes to that address, but she's gone from the car when he gets there. And he hasn't stopped or hasn't heard the door open or anything. And so he goes up to the house and knocks on the door and asks the people about it. And usually he spots a portrait of her on the piano or on the mantle or on the wall. He says, that's the girl. That's the one right there that was in my car. And they say, well, how could that be? That's our daughter who died in a car accident at such and such a place. And he said, that's where I picked her up 10 years ago. Sometimes they supposedly say she hitchhikes home on the anniversary of her death every year. And then the zinger here is that he goes to the cemetery, looks at her tombstone, and finds his sweater draped over the tombstone. Well, I found versions of that in the literature, in the folklore journals and collections from literally the turn of the century and the teens. Horse and buggy, horseback riding in a wagon or something like that. And it comes up through the war years. You'll get the hitchhiker predicting the end of the war. The war will end soon. It comes up to things like predicting the eruption of Mount St. Helens. It comes up to it being a male hitchhiker, very cleanly dressed, who says Jesus is coming soon and gets out of the car or vanishes from the car. They'll be on the freeway sometimes. In Utah, it's been incorporated into traditional Mormon folklore in that the hitchhiker will give some sort of advice in the context of Mormon practice, something like get your food supply in or be sure to pay your tithing or something, and then they will interpret the hitchhiker as one of the three Nephites, who are figures mentioned in the Book of Mormon who appear in other forms of Mormon legends. You get a hitchhiking Nephite legend. It's been made into popular songs. The plot has been used as a short story device. It's been used in television productions, Twilight Zone kind of things. When I introduced it back into the book here, I gave a Romanian version, one that I heard in Bucharest when I was there, and I decided just for the fun of it to go back and listen to a couple of the pop songs based on it. I printed the lyrics, the whole lyrics of one and a verse from the other. Maybe, I don't know if you remember these songs, Dickie Lee's record was Laurie or Strange Things Happen from 1965, and Bringing Mary Home was a sort of bluegrass piece that the Country Gentlemen and some other groups recorded. I also find it's highly localized in some places. In Chicago, they'll say it's Resurrection Mary. In Dallas, it's the Lady of White Rocks Lake and that sort of thing. So it gets very localized.
And you pointed out in your book that, was it Pee-wee's Big Adventure?
Oh, yeah, that's right. In the movie Pee-wee's Big Adventure, it's the kind of other side of it. There are some trucker versions of it where the ghost is not a hitchhiker but is the truck driver. And there's a wonderful scene in that movie where... what's her name? Large Marge.
Large Marge.
Large Marge scares the daylights out of Pee-wee. Everything scares Pee-wee. No, actually nothing scares Pee-wee in that. He just keeps going. But I sort of hate to admit I went to that movie and laughed my head off through the whole thing, but I also took notes on the Large Marge episode.
I want to be sure to ask you about hilarious accident stories. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of laughing in those. What is a hilarious? Could you tell a few and tell us what unites them?
Yeah, I dub them hilarious accidents. They're slapstick kind of adventures, accidents that would be uncomfortable if they happened to us, but which are just fun to laugh at. They're a little like cartoons where, you know, Roadrunner and Coyote do all these things, and they would hurt if it happened, but we consider it just a joke. Usually there's a sequence of them. For example, a guy needs to get up on his roof. He doesn't have a ladder. He thinks maybe, he's got to fix some shingles or adjust his television antenna or shovel snow off there. He thinks maybe the way to do it is put a rope over the house, tie one end of it to the car bumper, and the other end, the other side of the house, around his waist, and then a pal of his will get in the car and drive slowly away and hoist him up on the roof. Everything's all set. The guy comes around and says, okay, I'm ready to go, George. But the man's wife goes out the front door, jumps in the car. She doesn't know what's going on. She hasn't paid any attention. Drives off to the supermarket, pulling him over the house down the street, and poor fella has to go to the hospital. Well, that's bad enough, except while he's there, she paints the bathroom, a chore that he intended to do, and she figures she'll take care of it while he's gone. And she's just pouring the paint thinner down the toilet after cleaning the brushes on the day when they bring him back from the hospital. And he goes in to use the toilet, and he's smoking a cigarette, and he drops it in, and there's an explosion. So I have to call the paramedics or call the ambulance people back or whatever. And they put him on the stretcher, naturally face down, and they say, what happened to you? Well, you know, how'd you have this kind of accident? And he explains it was an exploding toilet. And one of the guys laughs so hard, he lets go of the corner of the stretcher and he falls off. So three accidents in a row, and sometimes they expand to more than that. And the general theme can take different forms of other kinds of accidents. I give here in my book the skiing story, which involves linked accidents. The woman skier who gets off the ski lift, the top of the chairlift, and decides, you know, to answer the call of nature around behind some trees, and she pulls her pants down over there, but she slips and slides down the hill, throws her arms out to try to gain her balance, and breaks her arm when it strikes a tree. She's brought in to the first aid room, and while she's there, they bring in a ski instructor. She's a ski instructor. How could you have an accident? He's got his ski instructor parka on, and she knows he's a good skier. And he said, well, I was just skiing today, and suddenly this woman came flying by backwards with her pants down, and I laughed so hard I ran into a tree. So you get the sequence involving somebody else and another kind of thing.
And as you say, the frequent punchline to these are, they laugh so hard they drop the stretcher.
That is often the concluding thing, that the accident is so funny to the people that are treating them that yet another accident occurs. Yeah.
Now, I don't know if it's a related set of rumors or not, but they're not funny. I didn't find these funny, but they're kind of the one reason that they weren't funny because they were so believable. But on the other hand, they're funny, and that's the mother's threat. Those set of stories.
That's pretty horrible. Yeah, that's pretty horrible. But I think it hits people, rather strongly when they hear it, because we have a tendency sometimes to use strong language for emphasis. I could kill for a Coke or a drink or something like that, or I'd kill you for that, we'd say. So the mother supposedly makes some threatening comment to one of her children, and then the other child carries it out, literally acts out what the mother has said. In one version, for example, the mother is crossing the English Channel or is on some kind of a ferry boat or something like that, and the baby is crying and crying, and she just wants to go and get some food and or a little fresh air or something, just like the baby goes to sleep. And she says, oh, if she doesn't stop crying, I'm going to put him out the port. If you don't stop crying, I'm going to put you out the porthole. And then she does run out on an errand and comes back, and her little daughter says, he didn't stop crying, so I put him out the porthole for you. See? So it's that kind of thing. We see in the story, it could be us. We say these terrible things and regret them later, but what if somebody carried them out? I think the what-if principle operates in a lot of these stories. They show us what might happen.
Are rumors ever used for political purposes, generated to manipulate some public belief?
Oh, I think that's definitely true. I think that falls somewhat outside my area, but certainly in wartime and times of disaster, the rumors fly, and especially in wartime, rumors about the enemy, atrocity stories, and stories about invasions, you know, that the enemy has reached our shores, and also demagogues and dictators and so on use rumors, I think, to excite their people. I don't know if that intersects with folklore or not. I mean, I think what they're doing, though, in a way it does, I think what they're doing is relying on the folk process of oral transmission and the credibility of the story being supported by everybody repeating it to further their ends. You know?
How about the nuclear waste story that you write about, the curse of the pharaohs?
Well, I put that in at the end as a bit of a joke because I started the book with a preface that was headed, "When will it ever end?" Because I thought my first book was it. I thought this is, you know, the definitive book on urban legends, and the ink wasn't dry before people were writing me saying you left out my favorite story, and new stories were popping up. And then the second book produced even more response, and I'm off and running. But then I concluded, I found this news story in the Wall Street Journal, I think it was, the idea that nuclear waste sites, which have to be secure and protected for a long, long time, you know, thousands of years in some cases. And some scholar at Indiana University, as it happened, I studied at Indiana University, and I, in fact, took a course with this guy. He's a very good anthropologist and linguist. And I don't know how serious he was, but he proposed, and he was quoted in the story saying, why don't we start Curse of the Pharaoh legends around these sites, stories to deter future generations from invading them, so that even if the signs that we put up fall down or decay or the use of the thing is forgotten, the legends will linger around and warn people away. I think he probably said it somewhat tongue-in-cheek. But it is curious that with such a modern current problem as nuclear waste and the length of time that it will have a potential dangerous effect, that somebody will turn to folklore as even a suggestion of a way to safeguard it.
You know what I was really struck that I read? That you said that some of the way that rumors are now being, or legends are now being communicated, is through electronic means. Mm-hmm. Like you had mentioned the Seismonet.
Yeah, my son is a computer science graduate student, and I am a computer missionary, is what I sometimes say in Salt Lake City. I'm not giving out tracts the way Mormon missionaries do, but I find myself often talking to people who are starting to write, like my students or people who want to do some writing, and saying, you know, you got to get a computer because it's brought me happiness. Well, I don't have a modem yet, and I don't read the computer bulletin boards, but my son Eric does, and a lot of my readers do, and they report to me and send me hard copy to prove it, that people are chatting via their modems, via their computers, over these nets, sharing jokes, sharing recipes, sharing stories, speculating about whether they can be true. I have something like a 20-page printout of comments about the Mrs. Fields story. I have another bunch of printouts about the one I call Mickey Mouse Acid. And what's gratifying to me is that sometimes after and these are all over the country. You know, you're sitting at home reading them on your screen and commenting. And it's gratifying to me that every now and then someone will say, this sounds like one of those Doberman stories that this man, and then they'll garble my name somehow, is writing about, and occasionally somebody will even give the title of the book. I think CB radio has allowed people to communicate in the same way, and even at a more familiar level, when we travel, waiting rooms, the jetways, the concourses, the long holding patterns, the long flights across the country, travelers, business people, vacationers, kids. People are sharing stories all the time, illustrating a point by telling a story they've heard.
What were some of the legends that you heard as a child that you later grew to understand were urban legends?
The first one I can remember is not in childhood, really. I'm not aware that I went to summer camp, but I don't remember hearing ghostly legends. What I remember are the funny songs we used to sing, and they still sort of echo through my head. But the first one I can really remember hearing, I think, was in high school, and it was the $50 Buick. I'm from Michigan, and it had to be a Michigan-made car, and it was the death car. Somebody had died in the car, and you could buy this car from someone because the smell of death permeated the upholstery, and nobody could stand to drive in it. But we were all sure we could stand it easily for $50. If we could just find that car, we'd buy it and air it out and leave the windows open and so on. But I then later heard it as a different model car, different price, in different locations, out on the desert rather than on a hunting trip or something like that. And in fact, I've found there are two other cheap car stories that are very common. So that when somebody said, well, the death car was a Corvette and the smell of death was not just in the upholstery but in the fiberglass body, I just saw this as continual variation on the old theme.
There's one called The Blind Date that I imagine would have been told to amongst guys in college or in those years anyway.
Yeah, I sort of restated that in my own words here. A lot of people have asked me, this is one of the stories that people wrote to me and said, why isn't it in your book? And I didn't give them the true answer, which was because when I send my mother my books, I want her to like them. She has gradually had to accommodate herself to the kind of stories people are telling. But I thought it was kind of a nightmare situation from, say, the 40s or 50s. The kid has a date, and the boy is going to go and buy some condoms. We used to say some supplies. He goes to the drugstore, and back then, I don't know about now, itself was a kind of a scary thing to do. You'd have to go in and ask for them, and the druggist knows what you're going to do with them. So he covers his embarrassment by bragging a little bit about the hot date he's got and the fun he's going to have. Then when he goes to pick up the girl, he discovers that the pharmacist that he bought them from is the girl's father. The story just ends there. You just have to imagine the horror of the moment.
Well, we're just about out of time, but real briefly, are there any rumors that are now on the horizon that are picking up steam that we should be hearing in the next couple of months?
Yeah, watch out for the story about the man stopped for a breathalyzer test when he's driving who, when the policeman is distracted by another accident, the man jumps in his car and drives home, only to learn later that he's jumped in the police car and driven home. I've got three or four versions of that have come to me, and I suspect it's going to be a hot one soon.
Great. Well, it's been a real pleasure speaking with you. Thanks very much for being here today on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guest has been Jan Harald Brunvand, and his last name, by the way, is spelled Brunvand, and his book, The Mexican Pet, is published by Norton. I'll tell you what's coming up on Fresh Air tomorrow and after this word from Shadow Traffic.
On the Schuylkill eastbound, 30 minutes from the Blue Route to City Avenue, westbound, slow at City, slow again near Conshohocken. If you're traveling the westbound turnpike, slow at the Valley Forge area because of an accident blocking the left-hand lane. In New Jersey, 73 southbound is jammed from 130 to Main Street, an accident still in the right-hand lane. Northbound, there's a quarter-mile rubbernecker delay. 42 is in great shape at this time. That's Shadow Traffic, and I'm John Butterworth on 91 FM WHYY.
And that Shadow Traffic report was from a grant from Philadelphia Electric. Well, tomorrow on Fresh Air, my guest will be Robert Mickelson, who's the producer of a new independently produced film called Hard Choices, which co-stars John Sayles. And then at 4 o'clock, we'll hear an interview which Terry Gross recorded with actor Alec Guinness, who will discuss his life on the stage and in the movies. This Sunday at 6 o'clock on the Best of Fresh Air, avant-garde composer and philosopher John Cage. He'll explain why he's committed to changing our preconceptions about music. Stay tuned for All Things Considered, coming up at 5 o'clock from National Public Radio. John Barth and Christiane Vaillancourt contributed to today's edition of Fresh Air. The engineers for this edition have been Audrey Vlobaitis and Paul Kerber. Amy Sallet is the associate producer of Fresh Air. Jordy Wiglarski is giving us production assistance this week. Thanks also to Tom Cellini and Abby Klebanoff for their production assistance. For Terry Gross, my name is Danny Miller. Thanks for listening. This is WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, listener-supported radio in the Delaware Valley. Stay tuned for All Things Considered.
Fresh Air was funded in part today by a grant from Eichler & Moffley Realtors, with offices in Chestnut Hill, Bluebell, and Doylestown. Eichler & Moffley Realtors, bringing buyers and sellers together for more than 25 years.
Good evening from National Public Radio in Washington. This is Noah Adams.
And I'm Wendy Kaufman with All Things Considered.
We need a new approach on debt because the present way we've handled debt policy has cost 1.4 million Americans their jobs. We need a bold action, and we need it now.
Senator Bill Bradley has a plan to provide debt relief to third world countries for one reason, so those countries can buy more American goods. Details tonight in All Things Considered.
Also, these stories: in Pakistan, arrested Benazir Bhutto, the leader of the opposition. Also, demonstrators killed in the streets.
A former U.S. Green Beret released by Vietnam. He'd been there trying to find a Vietnamese friend.
Contra forces planning new action in Nicaragua now that Congress has approved $100 million in new aid.
That and more. Now, this news.
This is Ann Bozell. An American drug agent was apparently kidnapped by Mexican police yesterday in Guadalajara and reportedly was later released by other police officers. Lucy Conger reports from Mexico City.
News of the detention of a DEA agent came exactly at the moment when U.S. and Mexican attorneys general were sitting down in Washington for high-level talks about a joint anti-drug campaign. At this sensitive time, officials are releasing few details about the incident, and according to one source, there may have been a misunderstanding. Mexican officials say the agent was picked up by state police in northwestern Mexico when he was traveling with a Mexican in a car that was carrying arms. Sources close to the incident say the DEA agent was tortured during his detention.